Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Glenn and Helen Show. Today's guest is Mary Cheney, who reports that when her father was thinking of accepting the nomination for vice president, she said, "I'd rather not be known as the vice president's lesbian daughter." But that was her fate, and she's now turned lemons into lemonade with her new book, Now It's My Turn.
Actually, there's lots more to the book than Mary Cheney's being gay, though that's the part that's gotten the attention, unfortunately. We'll be talking to her about her inside view of the 2000 and 2004 campaigns, her life with a political father, the role of blogging in campaigns, and more.
She also offers some advice for political aides and for aspiring campaign workers. We'll talk about that and other issues in just a minute.
We've got Mary Cheney on the phone now. Hi, Mary. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Well, we'll start off with, you talk some in the book about growing up in a political family, and there's were obviously some very good times, but when you were very young, your father had a heart attack at 37. What was that like for you, and how did your father cope?
You know, I think when you're a little kid, even when you're a big kid and an adult, I think having something happen to your parents is probably about everybody's worst fear. And in our case, it was Father's Day 1978. And my dad went to the hospital because two of the fingers in his left hand were tingling. And for some reason, that just set off the alarms in his head. So he went, and it didn't take him long to diagnose that he had a heart attack. And at that point, he was in the middle of running his very first congressional campaign, his very first run for elected office. And a lot of people speculated that he should drop out of the race. We had several family discussions about the matter ourselves. But ultimately, he decided to stay in, partly because he got great advice from one of his doctors. One of the first heart guys he went to said, look, hard work never killed anybody. It's doing what you hate. It's doing something you don't love. That'll put you in the grave. And so my dad really took that message to heart, so to speak, and decided that the best way to live his life was to deal with his heart disease, to handle it as responsibly as possible, but not to spend his whole life worrying about it.
And I think you can dwell on something like that. We were talking before, and, I had a heart attack at the exact same age at 37, and I think you can sit and you can spend the rest of your life dwelling on it and thinking about how bad that can be, but you can also use it to do something incredible like your father did.
Well, use it to do something incredible and use it to learn. In my dad's case, he is the first to admit he spent most of the 70s living on cigarettes and coffee. And he was given a second chance. And he quit smoking cold turkey, got much better about his diet, and started exercising regularly. So all in all, I think it turned out well.
Well, see, he got a better deal than Helen because she never smoked or anything. She was even a vegetarian. So she really should have been living high and enjoying it.
You know, I should have, because when I went to the hospital, they asked me, they looked at me and they said, have you been, we hate to ask you, but were you on drugs or smoking crack? And I'm like, no, I wish I had. I wish I'd done something, but never did anything.
Yeah, I should have had a little more red meat in your system.
There you go. Well, I do now. Let's switch topics. You said in your book you didn't want to be known as the vice president's lesbian daughter. Why do you think that people, especially it seems the Democrats, focus on that single issue so much?
Yeah, I honestly don't know. I mean, I've always been taught, especially by my parents, that you look at people as the individuals. Is this a good person? Is this a bad person? You look at their actions and who they are as a whole person. And I'm not really quite sure why, especially Democrats, tend to focus so intensely on what your demographic definition is.
Well, I guess they have to. Isn't that sort of the way they get votes? I mean,
well, apparently it doesn't work very well for them.
No, I guess not.
The last election.
Need to change the strategy.
Yeah, I remember, it's funny how much they're spinning the gay marriage issue now, but I remember that right after the election, Coase over at Daily Coase wrote, and his advice to people was to play up the gay marriage thing. He said, Marching order number one, therefore, is this. No matter whom you talk to outside our circles, begin to perpetuate the false, exaggerated notion that George Bush's victory was built not merely on various values issues, but on gay marriage specifically. You know, and that, do you think a lot of people listened?
I think some people did, but it's really been interesting. You know, I think gay marriage is an issue where people can have all sorts of different opinions. But what's really been interesting for me is to watch the Democratic Party for a couple things. One, that Democrats, you know, get a free pass on the issue of gay marriage from the gay and lesbian community all the time. You know, John Kerry was quoted in the New York Times a week before the 2004 election, saying, you know, look, my position on gay marriage is fundamentally the same as George Bush's.
Mm-hmm.
Yet he gets all this credit for being, you know, very supportive of gay rights. And if you just look in the last couple weeks, Howard Dean went on the 700 Club with Pat Robertson and managed to misquote the Democratic platform, you know, the platform of the party he's supposed to be the leader of, regarding same-sex marriage. You know, he claimed that the party's platform stated that marriage was between a man and a woman, when in fact that's not what their platform says.
Well,
yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, you know, it is interesting, I mean, thinking about the hostility in the media, and I am interested in the psychology of it. What's it like to be confronted with a relentlessly hostile media environment? I mean, it seems particularly hostile towards Republicans.
It is particularly hostile towards Republicans. In the book, I've got a chapter that's titled Anybody But the New York Times that talks about the fact that in 2004, it wasn't just that we had to run against John Kerry and John Edwards or, you know, Democrats in general. It was that we were really running against the media. There's a quote in the book from, I want to say, Evan Thomas from Newsweek, when he was on one of those talking head shows inside the Beltway, and he said, you know, look, we need to talk about media bias here. And he projected that the media's bias towards Democrats was going to be worth up to 15 points for John Kerry and John Edwards. I mean, that's huge.
How did you cope during the campaign?
Yeah, just the best you could. One thing that's been really interesting the last couple of election cycles is how alternatives to the mainstream media have really popped up. Things like blogs, quite honestly, have had such a huge impact on our electoral process. A great example of that is the whole controversy over the president's National Guard records. When CBS came out with these highly questionable documents claiming that they were, you know, 100% supported by the facts, and as conservative bloggers showed, they weren't. And that was, I think that was a real turning point for a lot of people regarding the media and their bias.
Yeah, I think they still are trying to extract their 15%. I think it's in terms of 15 points off of George Bush's approval rather than 15 points for his opponent now. But, you know, if you were to add 15 points to where Bush is, he'd be doing okay.
He's doing really well.
There is kind of a relentless, you know, rain of negativity on just every topic.
Well, and it's really amazing because I can't help but notice, and I said this in a few interviews, when people start talking to me about, you know, bad poll numbers or whatever, say, you know, look, think about, you know, let's say you and I sit down 10, 15 years from now, and we look back on this period in our country's history. What we are going to see is a country that hasn't been hit by terrorists in five years. It's been 5 years since September 11th. We have an economy that's growing. You know, we have, you know, 50 million people in Iraq and Afghanistan who are free today who weren't 5 years ago. You know, these are incredible accomplishments, and accomplishments that all Americans should be very proud of, and that, quite frankly, we should be hearing more about, but you wouldn't know it if you were watching the general media today.
Yeah, I mean, I've got even people, when I talk to them, they talk about, oh, the economy's so bad, the war's going so poorly, and I'll say, well, where did you hear all this?
Cause, exactly.
And they're like, oh, yeah, I watched the news, and you're like, gosh, do you really believe everything you hear? And, you know, I've read recently also that people, other people have lost a lot of faith, I mean, in the New York Times or a lot of the mainstream media. There's a huge percentage of people who don't believe a word, you know, a word they say. So it seems to be divided between people who believe anything and then people who don't, that question a little bit more and listen to alternative media.
Well, one of the things that's really disturbing isn't even so much they put a bad picture on it. A lot of times they just don't even talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this past weekend, Prime Minister, I'm going to pronounce his name incorrectly, I'm sure, Malaki of Iraq, announced the formation of his cabinet. There's a couple positions left to be filled, but most of them are completely filled. That is a huge accomplishment if you think of all the Iraqis have done in the 3 years since the war. And you hear very little about it in the mainstream media, and I think it's really disappointing. I think it should be everywhere. It's such a huge accomplishment.
Why do you think, what do you think it's doing to people in the White House now, this negativity in the media? Do people like your father or George Bush get upset about it, or does it affect them?
Yeah, I actually have to admire both my dad and President Bush in how they sort of handle the criticism. And they both have this wonderful gift to be able to take the long view, to know that, look, we are doing what's right for the country. We are doing what it takes to get this, to keep this country safe and to keep this country moving forward. And that's what they're really focused on. They're not really sitting there fretting about what the latest public opinion poll says. And quite frankly, from my perspective, I'd much rather have leaders who are focused on doing what's right and, getting the job done than on, say, what's politically expedient or popular at the moment.
Yeah, in the book you write about candidates and officials living in the bubble. And, it sort of cuts both ways. On the one hand, you don't want people to pay too much attention to the news. I think part of the Clinton administration's problem was that they just, blew the prevailing wind based on what the latest polls were. On the other hand,
one of my favorite things is that Bill Clinton actually took a vacation, decided his vacation location based on public opinion polls.
On the other hand, you don't want to be too isolated. And one of the criticisms of the White House now is that it's kind of out of touch with the base. And in fact, we had Ken Melman on the show a couple of weeks ago, and I sort of got a feeling that he didn't really appreciate the strength of sentiments on things like immigration and all. How do people stay in touch?
One of the best ways you do, and one of the things that works really well for my parents, is you get out of Washington. If you get out of D.C., and you get out beyond the Beltway, you really, it's a great reality check. It was actually one of my dad's and my mom's favorite parts of the 2004 campaign, was getting out and getting to see and hear what people are really concerned about. With my dad, we used to do these town hall meetings where people could come and ask him questions. And it's a great way to get a feeling for what's on the country's mind. And I think you're seeing people do more of those, especially the president's been doing a lot of them lately. And I think that's a really good way, because quite honestly, if you're in Washington for any length of time, it's the chattering classes talking to themselves, basically. It's very different than the way the rest of the world thinks and operates.
Yeah, in the book, you talk about the role of blogs in the campaign and how campaigners and White House staffers read the blogs regularly. Do you think they played a big role in sort of day-to-day perceptions of the mood? And do you think people in the White House are reading blogs and getting cues from those now?
Well, I sure hope they're reading blogs now. I read several blogs on a daily basis just because, quite frankly, the mainstream media has gotten so bad, so anti-Republican, so anti-Bush, so anti-conservative, that it doesn't, I think, represent the thinking of most of the American people.
What blogs do you read?
Pardon?
What blogs do you read?
Actually, I read a bunch of different ones. Let me pull up my favorites list here.
Okay.
I read, Instapundent's on there. Shel Malkin's on there. Tammy Bruce is on there. There's, Gay Patriots on there. There's actually a bunch that I look at, once or twice a week at least. And it's just, quite frankly, I just think it's really helpful to sort of get these different viewpoints. That's one of the things I like so much about the Internet and about blogging in general. There are just so many different viewpoints represented.
Do you think they'll play a big role in 2008, the blog?
Oh, I'm sure they will. I think they're playing a big role in 2006, but in 2008, you're going to see every candidate's going to have a blog. In 2004, it was a huge deal that Howard Dean had a blog. But every candidate's going to have a blog in 2008. They're going to, I'm sure, encourage their supporters to have blogs. I think you will also probably see, especially presidential campaigns, do more outreach to bloggers. I'm not really sure they did that too much in 2004, but you'll probably see people respecting the impact that bloggers have more than they did in previous elections.
And they're doing podcasts, too. Some of the, you know, Bill Frist has a podcast now, and I've noticed a bunch of the, you know, the bigger politicians are all getting podcasts, which I think is really interesting.
Well, especially given how much time people are spending in their cars.
Oh, yeah.
It's a great way. It's a great way to communicate.
Right, and very personal, which is it's psychologically, I think, very helpful to them to have that personal connection where you feel like when you're listening to a podcast that you're actually talking to the person.
It is. It's much more. It is. It's much more personal, much more intimate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the book, you offer some pretty good advice for people who are going to work in a political campaign. And, you know, I've never been a personal aide to a politician, but I did manage a rock and roll band, and I actually noticed a surprising degree of similarity there. what advice do you have for people who want to work on a political campaign or to get involved, first of all?
A great way to get involved is just go volunteer. I don't know of a single political campaign that'll turn down volunteers. And just go and work as hard as you can, do whatever you can. That's usually the best way to get noticed. Working on a campaign from either a congressional campaign or a presidential campaign is one of the most rewarding things you can do. It's also one of the toughest things you can do. Basically, for the 2004 presidential campaign, most staffers had to put their life on hold for, you know, a year and a half or 2 years. You live, breathe, eat, sleep, drink the campaign. And it is wonderful, and you completely go through withdrawal when it's done. It took me probably a good month before I would wake up and, you know, not worry that I'd missed the motorcade or overslept.
What do you do if you have, like you do, a partner or a family, and, you know, you're on the road like that? Isn't that hard?
It is incredibly tough. I'm very fortunate. Heather was just incredible during both 2000 and 2004. But there's an awful lot of people who, you know, their marriages end mm-hmm. when they work on a political campaign. You don't get to spend much time at home. When you do, you're usually exhausted, or you're sitting there with your BlackBerry returning people's emails. It's incredibly difficult. And, you know, I think you have to have an enormous amount of respect, not just for the people who work on the campaign, but for people who, you know, are at home supporting them, basically.
Yeah, I think the people who cover them get pretty worn out, too. And I think actually the just sheer exhaustion factor explains a lot of weirdness in both the campaigns and the press as they get on.
You do. I mean, and you start obsessing over very strange things. I tell that chapter, I think it's called Inside the Bubble, in the book. I tell stories about the way people adapt to life on the campaign trail. You know, one of the first lessons you learn is that you own a lot of black suits because they don't show dirt and they don't show wrinkles. people find odd ways, odd hobbies on the trail. I spent the 2004 campaign cycle riding around in the motorcade with a guy who took photos of every vehicle that he rode in. So at the end of the campaign, he had this scrapbook full of pictures of minivans from all across the country. You adapt different ways, and it is a world just in and of itself.
Well, what do you think the prospects are for the Republicans in 2008? Any ideas?
Yeah, I have heard all sorts of rumors about who's running, who's not running. I've heard McCain, Frist, Romney, George Allen. You know, there are a ton of candidates out there. I think it's going to be a lot of fun to watch. Frankly, I really haven't. My focus has been more on, you know, doing what we can to make sure that we keep both houses in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
I think 2008 is going to be a very fun one to watch, but I think we've got to get through 2006 first.
Well, what do you want people to know from your book about your father? Because after I read the book, I felt like I came to kind of know your family a little bit more. What do you want people to know about him or anything?
Well, I'm glad you learned something about my family because that was sort of one of my goals.
Mm-hmm.
Really, one of the things that's very interesting to me after all these years of watching my dad in the public eye, there is something that happens to public figures, particularly politicians. That is that the media, you know, sort of create these caricatures of them. In my dad's case, it's, you know, this Darth Vader-like malevolent figure,
mm-hmm.
which is so far removed from the real Dick Cheney. Yes, my dad is tough. I think that's a good thing.
I do, too. I liked your description. I loved your description where you said he had threatened to pushed somebody out of the airplane.
It was a New York reporter.
I got to say, I laughed at that one. It sounded like something I can understand that.
You know, he is tough, but he's fair, mm-hmm. and he is honest, and he is smart, and he is honorable, and he is a great dad, and he is a great grandfather, and you know, he is so dedicated to public service and to doing what is right for this country. I hope people sort of get to see an image of the real Dick Cheney.
And your description of him when you were talking about when you told him that you were gay and your description was just, you know, that he hugged you. I just thought that was very touching, just that he really did all the right things. I mean, if you were a psychologist and you were talking to a parent, you couldn't imagine they would do anything better than just...
I am incredibly lucky in having the parents that I do. My dad, you know, reacted exactly right. He hugged me. He said, "You're my daughter, and I love you, and I just want you to be happy." I would hope that more parents would react that way to their kids.
Mm-hmm.
I just sort of offer it up as evidence that I am just so incredibly fortunate to have the parents that I do.
Well, tell us what aspects of your book have gotten the least attention in the media coverage of it that you think deserve more.
One of the things, I wrote a chapter called SLOTUS, which stands for Second Lady of the United States, that in a lot of ways tells stories about my mom. And I think one thing that frequently gets missed, especially by the media, is how impressive my mom is. Here's a woman, she's got a PhD in English literature, she taught in colleges, she was an accomplished spokesperson, she hosted a political talk show on CNN for several years. She was chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. She's written several books, several very successful children's books. And a lot of times people just sort of don't pay that much attention to her. And the other important thing to remember about my mom is she's probably my dad's best political advisor and always has been. And just the influence and the impact she has on him, whether it's, you know, offering up her political opinion or just being there. She is his best advisor and his best friend.
Is that something typical to being the wife of the vice president, or is it something, I mean, is there some reason that the second lady or whatever they call them tends to get overlooked? Or?
Well, in a lot of cases, I think the second lady does tend to get overlooked a little bit, but, part and parcel of the deal. But it's also important to remember, my mom is the first wife of the president or the vice president who actually has a job, who mm-hmm. works, you know, on her own. She's a fellow at AEI in D.C. She is continuing to write children's books, and actually she just signed a deal for a new book with Simon & Schuster. She's very happy sort of being low-key, but I always wish more people would, just realize everything that she has accomplished. It's part of the reason why my sister and I have always, had this faith that you can just, whether you're male or female, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. What matters is that you do the best job that you can do. And my mom, one of the most important lessons she taught us is that, you don't ever let someone's prejudice or someone's perceptions get in the way. You go do whatever you have to do to get the job done.
That sounds very similar to Condi Rice. I was reading a biography of her one day, and it sounds very similar to how her parents taught her and probably why she accomplished so much.
I mean, the influence that parents can have, not just in the things that she taught us, but mm-hmm. just, her own example.
Mm-hmm.
I remember her telling me when we were kids that when she got her PhD, she went and interviewed at several universities and was told, this is in the early 70s, and was told flat out that they didn't hire married women.
Mm.
She managed to accomplish an awful lot in a not very friendly time.
Yeah, and I know our daughter loves her books. I didn't even know it was your mom, but A is for Abigail was one of our daughter's favorite books when she was younger. And you write some really good books.
She's got another one coming out about the 50 states, which is also very good. I've seen some of the early pages.
Okay, is that a children's book?
Yep.
Great.
But I think that's probably one of the other things I wish people could take away from the book is how just incredible my mom is.
Well, Well, I think you did a good job in the chapter. I was always wondering what a SLOTUS was, and I learned when I read it. So
what's next for you now? You know, when you write a book, it kind of puts a capstone on your life up to that point. And what comes next?
I haven't made any decisions yet. I'd like to write another book at some point, but right now I've been so busy promoting this one, which I'm incredibly proud of, and which I really enjoyed writing, that I haven't given too much thought to what comes next. I'm sure whatever it is, it'll be an adventure. It has been so far.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you guys for having me on.
We appreciate your time. Thank you.
Well, that was fun.
You know, that was, and it was interesting talking to Mary afterwards about her life and about, you know, being an author and the fact that actually beyond being an author, she's just a really nice person.
Yeah, we wound up yakking with her on the phone for about 15 or 20 minutes after we finished the interview, which we don't usually do.
She's like one of those kind of people you'd love to go out and just have lunch with and just talk about anything with.
Yeah, you know, I predict she's going to have a big future for herself in politics if she wants one, but she sounds like she might be just a little bit too sane and sensible to want one.
Well, that's too bad for politics, but it sounds like she'll have a happier life.
Yeah, I don't think I'd want to be a politician, and I think, her exposure to it's probably as much as any sane and sensible person would probably want. We hope you'll be exposed to more of these podcasts in the future. You can tune in at instapundit.com or drhelen.blogspot.com for updates, or you can subscribe via iTunes. We like it when you do that because it moves us up those all-important iTunes charts. Well, they'd be all-important if, like, we got money for it or something. But anyway, we like it when you subscribe. Anyway, we'll be back whenever we feel like it. So stay tuned and have fun on the Internet.
Talk to you next time.